All right, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's November 7th, 2012. And I want to do a series of discussions and presentations and maybe some practices through the remainder of this year on the theme of refuge, which is a fundamental theme in Buddhism. It's also a very fundamental theme in other wisdom traditions. And one way to think about it, and I'm going to kind of try to look at it in a fresh way, has to do with what we treasure. So treasure is a word that has two kinds of meanings. It is that which we treasure, and it's the act of treasuring. Treasuring is to treat something, in a deep sense, as sacred, which means setting it aside or apart, not idolizing it, not craving it or essentializing it, but valuing it, thinking that it's important enough to protect, like a tree we care deeply about. I think about Julia Butterfly Hill, who sat in a tree for 2 years to prevent it from being cut down. Or people organizing, for example, to protect the Marin Headlands or so much open space in the Bay Area. Or people going out on a limb to really stick up for their child who needs an organ transplant or better kind of schooling or training, because we treasure, you know, we take care of what we treasure, and we also take refuge in it. So it's in that context then that I want to explore with you a series of both traditional refuges in Buddhism, as well as some others that I'm going to throw out and make room for those you have yourself. As we approach the holidays of Thanksgiving, as well as Christmas or Hanukkah or other sacred occasions at this time of year, it just seems to me to be really appropriate to focus on that which we value, inside and outside us. Okay, so far? All right, good. So, I want to talk about the three refuges in Buddhism and then focus on the first of these and also talk about what it means to take refuge or find refuge in something. And if you're up for it, do a little practice with you about this. So first of all, as you may well know, someone is Buddhist in traditional understandings of that word, if that word means anything at all. Someone is Buddhist who takes refuge in what are called the three jewels. The jewels of, in three words, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Buddha meaning a combination of the historical teacher in whom one has confidence. It also means that which is in us already, that is innately wakeful and warm-hearted. You may recall that in the sitting practice today, when I was offering my suggestions around 7 o'clock, 7:05, that I repeatedly came back to opening to and giving yourself over to and accessing your own sense of wakefulness, the capacity to be present, to know, to be aware, and also your own fundamental warm-heartedness, lovingness, kindness, caring. These are qualities that are innate and present in all of us. And you may recall right now what it was like to bring those to mind in your practice, and if perhaps you found yourself able to give yourself over increasingly to your own natural wakefulness and your own natural warm-heartedness and let them meditate you. Okay? So that's Buddha. Dharma means both that which is true and accurate representations of what's true. Words, theories, teachings, explanations, images, intuitive knowings, that's Dharma as well. So it's reality and accurate maps to reality. And in a slightly more narrow sense, in a narrower sense, the Dharma is understood to be the lineage of teachings in Buddhism, rooted in the teachings of the historical Siddhartha himself, and then radiating out from him. I think of it a little bit like a cone rising historically from this nexus, this point of origin, 2,500 years ago, and then spreading and also refining and being enriched in various ways through the centuries, and here we are with them today, with this extraordinary and historically utterly unprecedented opportunity to access, literally at the click of a mouse, any aspect of Buddhist contemplative wisdom you might possibly want, and by extension, all the world's rich sources of contemplative wisdom. It's really quite remarkable. So that's the body of the Dharma, in which is seen as a jewel and in which one can take refuge. Then there is Sangha. Sangha is an interesting word. Traditionally, it means a gathering of monastics on the path. Good company on the path. The original meaning of Sangha had a very vertical dimension to it. To take refuge in Sangha meant taking refuge in the monastics, particularly the senior monastics, and particularly the most senior of all, the ones who had entered at least the first stage of the four stages of awakening, extreme entry, and ideally all the way up to arahants. So this was the Buddha's notion that after his own passing, certainly as a body, that the teaching, the tradition that he had founded would live on and be guided by its most senior practitioners. Not because they were great theologians or theoreticians, but frankly because they were great saints. In other words, they walked their talk with every cell of their being and every syllable coming out of their mouth. That was the original notion of Sangha. Now, you may find yourself a little surprised by that notion, as I was when I first came across it. Because I understood Sangha to mean, when I entered Buddhism over the last 25-ish, pushing 30 now years or more actually, that it was like, it meant congregation as a horizontal dimension. There was no hierarchy, because I was a hippie, right? And this was California, and this was the West, and this is America. We're very egalitarian here. And to my surprise, I found that the original meaning of Sangha had a real sense of, frankly, respect for wisdom, respect for people who were demonstrably further along. Mixed up in that was a lot of trouble, just blind allegiance to authority and misuse of authority and so forth. But you can see these two dimensions, both the vertical one, having faith in those who are farther along and receiving their transmission, opening to the practical wisdom flowing through them, as well as the dimension of Sangha that has to do with, sort of all of us in this together. We can be spiritual friends with people both at our own level and, frankly, spiritual friends with people who, honestly, have burned off more of their mind. And also we can be spiritual friends with people who haven't burned off as much mind as we have. Obviously, there are pitfalls of evaluation and comparing and so forth in this consideration, but any time you think about or open to the notion of people that are further along or not as far along, you know, there is some rough truth to it. I'll just say for myself, it's very clear to me that there are people that are further along than me, and I'm very interested in what they have to say. I keep my own counsel. The Buddha's final advice on his own deathbed was to be a light unto yourself. Keep your own counsel, fundamentally, judging by what really works for you, pragmatically. That said, a receptivity to the influence, putting oneself in the field of wholesome influence, you know, rising currents like a bird soaring over the hills, wants to find those updrafts and then be lifted by them. Why not look for those updrafts that are available to us, especially these days, with a click of a mouse? So those are the three classic jewels: Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. What does it mean to take refuge or to find refuge? A classic way to understand it, and you can do it right now in your own mind, is that you go to something. I go for refuge. Some of the traditional chants have that construction in them. I go to refuge. What's the problem with that? It locates the refuge dualistically over there. Now, in some ways, there's truth. And there, it touches us somehow. You know, if you think about traditional physical refuges, like in Hawaii, there are these places of refuge. You know, right, in those environments, if you make it to a place of refuge, even if the other tribe is chasing behind you and if they can catch you one step this side of the refuge, they can kill you and eat you or whatever. But if you make it across that line, nanny, 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 no, you can't do that. That might really tick them off, you know. But you're supposedly safe, all right? So we go to these places. Think about places that are refuge for you in a kind of concrete way. For me, woods, wilderness. I'm always happy under trees. I don't know why I'm always happy under trees. What are refuges for you? You know, honestly, wherever my wife is, that's a good refuge. Where my cat is, you know, cat's not at the same level of wife, but that's a sense of refuge there. What are your own personal refuges? So, okay, so there's a place for going to. But what about turning it around? What if we relate to the refuge as where we come from, where we've already arrived? Finding refuge or abiding as the refuge and being carried along by it. Abiding as nature, abiding as love, abiding as the capacity for wakefulness and warm-heartedness and the presence of wakefulness and warm-heartedness in you right now. Abiding as wisdom right now. In the refuge of wisdom, abiding as all the spiritual friends you have who are alive and well in your mind right now. That's a different way to relate to refuge. I like both ways myself. Both of them move my needle, float my boat, have a pragmatic effect on me. But they're different ways to relate to refuge. You could try it right now. Pick something that's really meaningful to you and important, really feeds your soul. It doesn't have to be the right thing, you know, that anything will do, any port in a storm. And then in your mind, and you can do it with more than one thing, we'll do a little thought experiment here. Start out by saying, I go for refuge in, or I go to this for refuge. So try that. I'll be quiet for half a minute. Okay, and then play around, and you can fiddle with the wording however you like, with language with the same thing, like taking refuge in, or abiding in, or abiding as, and then fill in the blank, whatever this was. Try that for about half a minute. Okay, coming back. So first notice the impact on you of a minute and a half of opening to refuge. And then second, what was the difference, if any, between the notion of going to a refuge over there compared to giving over to it here? Yeah, Emily. The latter was more embodied. Uh-huh, thank you. Okay, great, please.
I just felt at rest.
In both, or one more than the other?
The second one definitely allowed me to rest. It felt heavy, good in a good way.
Yeah.
And resting.
Thank you. That's a nice word, by the way, resting in refuge, or resting in fill in the blank, you know, resting in the teacher, resting in the teaching, resting in the community of the taught, which are ways to understand Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Teacher, teaching, and taught. Okay, another person? Yeah, Julie.
I felt with Emily a lot more strength with the second one.
Yeah.
That was inside.
Yeah.
And compared to the first one, that was a much more gentle and diffuse.
Mm-hmm.
Restfulness and peacefulness and refuge.
Okay, good. Yeah. So far, I think we have 3 out of 3 votes for the second way. Now, I think both are good, but yeah.
Well, I found it easier to go into the first one.
Uh-huh.
It was a place.
Yeah.
It was something physical. It was more tangible.
Yeah.
The second one took a little more work.
Yeah, yeah.
But once I got into it, it felt deeper.
It felt deeper. Okay, good. The soundtrack. That's great. Okay. I don't know what they're doing upstairs.
Warm enough.
Do you think it's upstairs or?
Oh, yeah.
Are they doing something upstairs?
They do sing a lot.
They do.
Okay.
Never heard of acoustic.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll just let it flow through and work on steadiness of mind and know that I'll be emailing the powers that be here later tonight. What's up? Because for me, honestly, this is a refuge, you know, and I want to concretely protect it for you. So, you know, anyway. Yeah, last person, then I'll move on.
The second one washed over me like a wave. It was so easy and effortless.
Yeah.
And it was so enlightening that what I was going to for the refuge was.
Uh-huh. That is really great, isn't it, to get that?
Yeah, it was a real shock.
Yeah. So easy to reside in. Isn't that revelatory when we get that? You know, it really goes to this very deep notion in Buddhism that what we're really doing is uncovering the jewel that was always right there, right under our nose. The treasure, using that word again. You know, isn't that interesting? Through treasuring, we discover treasure. That was always already here. So now, to focus, if we can, on the first of these refuges, that, and we'll be exploring a lot of them, and I invite you to play around with this practice. I want to zero in on the first one, Buddha, and how we understand that. Now, there's a tendency that many have noted in the West, and I think especially in America, to resist the notion of an authority figure teacher, a guru, a prophet. I remember listening recently to someone on the radio saying that this idea of turning people into everybody's a rock star really bothered her. Okay, so it's interesting to explore what comes up for us around relating to Buddha, what we mean by that as a refuge. So in a moment, I'll invite you to pick a partner, and I'll give you 2 questions. And as usual, this will be quick, and there'll be a speaker and a listener, then you'll switch roles. You can always sit this out if you like, and then we'll come back and discuss it. And I'll just tell you right now what the 2 questions are. So the first question is, how do you relate to taking refuge in, using that word broadly, that which protects us, that which fuels us, that which inspires us, that which has a feeling of home in it? What's there for you about taking refuge in the historical Siddhartha, the historical Buddha? Second, what's there for you in taking refuge in, or what was your word? Residing, resting or residing in. The other way to relate to that word, as what Buddha means or is or refers to, related to the original meaning of the word Buddha, which is to know or to see utterly. What does it mean for you to relate to Buddha as your own natural, impersonal, profound wakefulness and warm-heartedness? Consciousness and love. Even a sense of that which really moves beyond any sense of personality, even out to something perhaps infinite, if that's meaningful to you, in terms of consciousness and love. Okay, you got the two questions? And I'll remind you. Get a partner, spread out, pick an A and a B. A's always go first. Anybody want a partner who doesn't have one? Get an A, get a B. Want a partner? You don't have one? Anybody else want a partner? I'll talk to you. Okay, good. A's, get ready. So A's, your turn for about a minute and a half. It'll be quick. All right, A's. What does it mean to you, or what's there for you around the notion of taking refuge in the historical Buddha, historical Siddhartha? A's begin, the human, the individual, the man, the fellow who walked out on his wife and baby son and was an ascetic for 7 years, became awakened, made peace with his family, and we're practicing his teachings 2,500 years later. That guy, Coach Buddha, I mean with no disrespect. Okay, A's? What's it like for you to take refuge in that human being? Okay, begin. Hi. Do you want to sit or stand up? What's your name?
Eileen.
I feel like I know you or have met you. No, but you're new here, yeah.
I'm new.
Yeah. Can I get you a chair?
Thank you.
Want to go first? So what's there for you about and taking refuge in the historical Buddha?
Thought about that has to do with the authority that I experienced in the tradition that I grew up in, which was Catholic, which was not a real positive experience. But I'm here because I read your book, and I've been to some meditations before, and I'm intrigued enough to keep kind of coming back and saying, okay, well, let me find out a little bit more about this first.
Yeah. Good. So what I hear you say is a kind of healthy caution, wait and see, some sense of value, and, you know, judge for yourself. Sounds great. Let me give a little time signal. Start wrapping it up, A's. You have to live with that when you're my partner. I'll just tell him something. And then get ready to switch. Okay, B's, your turn. What's it like to take refuge in the historical Buddha? B's, begin. Do you want to keep going or I can talk? Okay. Well, you know, apart from my dig at, you know, his walking away from his, I meant that to kind of rouse people up a little bit, to get them to realize that this is a person like us. It's 2,500 years ago, a very different time, but a real person who went through his own struggles and steps. I like it a lot. I mean, I've read a lot of the original discourses of the Buddha, and there's a certain amount of noise, you know, of verbiage that's dropped in clearly by other people, and translation issues and so forth. It's 2,500 years, and it was an oral tradition for several centuries before it was written down in any lasting way. That said, for me, a voice comes through. You know, like, for example, a voice, and for me, comes through the Gospels, distinct from all the other stuff that people wrapped around it. There's this teaching from Jesus, for what it's worth. There's this teaching. And I find it, I have great confidence in the Buddha I kick the tires again and again on what he says, and it's very psychological. It's not metaphysical. It's just really down to earth. I look at it in terms of my own feelings or desires, and it's very, very accurate.
You mentioned Jesus in that.
All right, coming back. How was that? What that is significant to you, did you get out of that in terms of taking refuge? Great.
You know what I noticed when I was talking to Sundara was that when I'm trying to be skillful in difficult situations or trying to not cultivate the wholesome, those things in a situation, and concentrating on those things, but I'm not really thinking about taking care of myself. And this refuge thing that you're talking about is like, oh yeah, well, I can take care of myself also while I'm trying to be skillful.
Right.
And that's kind of a light bulb.
Great. That's great. Yeah. Abiding in a good place here, dealing sometimes with difficulty there. It's so much easier to deal with difficulty there, abiding in a good place here. Yeah, that's great. Other people? Great.
As far as looking at the Buddha and then seeing the human nature inside myself and thinking of imperfections, I was thinking it would be nice to know of imperfections that the Buddha had. Instead of a perfect being.
Right.
I need a few things.
Ah. Well, that's a little bit why I started out by talking about him as an historical figure. To get a sense, to me it's more meaningful in a funny way that, this is me personally, that he was an historical figure. And he had his own issues, right? And so to me that somehow makes it better. On the other hand, the notion that it's possible for a human being and a human brain to so thoroughly develop itself and change itself and then see into the truth of things that literally there's this is the operational definition of awakening, that when you're on the other side of complete awakening, it's irrevocable. At the highest level, no longer can suffering arise at all. And the conditions that lead to kind of this ongoing chain of painful existence just have evaporated. So in that sense, there is a kind of perfection, but historically, it's also clear when you look at those people, they're unusual, they're rare, but they exist, okay? Michael Jordan is unusually talented as a basketball player, but he exists, okay? Einstein, unusually talented as a mathematician, but exists. Anyway, my point is that when you look at these various people, they have their own, I guess, biology or body-mind through which the radiance shines. You know, they have their own qualities. Some are more extroverted, some are more introverted, some are more nurturing, some are not. They have their own qualities. So we can take refuge in their humanness, even if there just no longer is any kind of craving leading to suffering. So what was it like to tip it over and open to the possibility that already present within you, without you needing to change in any way, without you needing to improve or be competent or attain, that actually already in you or moving through you or arising as you is some kind of fundamental awakeness and love?
Buddhist teaching. And then when you talk about having that accessibility. going to that place where it's quiet. And that's a completely different type of energy. So the two kind of, they feed off each other. One is like the outward search for the truth, and the other is just finding that place inside yourself.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. I was, you know, just sort of feeling into it myself, and it's like this awareness of what's unchanging. It's like all this stuff is changing, sights, sounds, thoughts, feelings. And then there's something also present in the mind. You can look, you locate it right now, that is never changed by any of the changes. And then you can look closely at its qualities, and people keep reporting, certainly my experience, that there's a quality of awareness, wakefulness, that is untroubled, and a leaning toward, you know, a warmth, a warm-heartedness, a kindness, a tenderness, you know, no matter what else happens. What's it like to register that as an opportunity to reside in, to rest in, to take refuge in? Yeah. Emily, I was looking at the altar here to see this figure here, and it's actually not a Tara, but I want to show you something. If you think about the imagery that's often used, especially in Tibet, for the aspect, if you will, of Buddha nature that is this warm-heartedness, compassion, you know, kindness for all beings, I'm going to kind of do it. It's a figure of a female figure who is seated essentially, I'm not going to do this perfectly, kind of like this, you know? Yeah, at Spirit Rock, you can, in the back of the meditation hall, other places, she's sort of like this, kind of. I'm not going to do it perfectly. She might have a hand on the ground, and there's like a hand here, and there's a smile. And this is the imagery of the absolute epitome of warm-heartedness, love, compassion, kindness. And so there's this capacity to just be touched by all the sorrows of the world, infinite compassion, and yet there's a certain lightness to it, a certain presence touching the earth, being rooted, and still feeling joy. You know, there's an untroubled joy amidst infinite compassion, holding all the pain of the world. I think that's kind of at the center of that, you know, that which doesn't change. It's not changed by that which changes. It feels like there's a sweetness in it. It's sweet. That might be a way to that. So, and you might look at imagery of Tara. I'm going to mispronounce it. I never get it right. Avalokiteshvara. Yeah, like they said. That's it. So... but I hear you, and it's the bringing together of the two. And people often will say, you know, what's really clear is the first one, wakefulness, and the warm-heartedness may come in over time. Okay, maybe anybody else? So just what's useful for you or potentially meaningful for you? What's a takeaway for you about this idea of residing in or taking refuge in or abiding as natural Buddha nature, bodhicitta, you know. Citta's consciousness, the consciousness of Buddha.
Luminosity is just the word that has resonated for me personally.
Yeah. Can you say more what you mean by that? Because for me, sometimes that word has felt abstract somehow. Yeah. How do you experience? You know,
how I experience luminosity is that at the core of me is an aliveness and a spark that I feed. And I feed it by absorbing the energy that comes to me from all of life.
Yeah. Oh, I get
it's
it. That's great.
Simple beingness.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Luminosity.
Thanks.
From our inner nature, from my inner nature.
Yeah.
That I relate to when I feel at this time on the planet, all of us are being fed an incredible, wonderful barrage to feed our luminosity.
Yeah.
More than any other time in the history of human beings, beyond what Buddha ever had, Siddhartha.
Yeah, thank you. Now I get it. That's good. I appreciate it. Well, let me, if I could, just offer one last thought before we wrap up, then we'll just sit for a minute and let it sink in. One aspect, too, of this wakefulness or warm-heartedness is its sense, its impersonality. I think sometimes we can, look at someone and say, you are love. And they could look at you and go, you are love. And you could feel the truth of it. I am love. And you could watch them register, I am love, over there. And that's great. It's a lot better than I am hate, all right? You know, I am snark. I am nastiness. I am mean-spiritedness. You know, love is a lot better. But just play with it for a second. You can feel the way that it feels personal and psychological. It's a nice, good feeling. It's good. But I think the ultimate opportunity for natural wakefulness and natural warm-heartedness, however we language that, is you start feeling that there's something that's trans the personality. Now, maybe it's trans the personality inside the biological body-mind, or maybe it's trans the personality because it goes out to something infinite. It's a mystery, for me at least. I can't prove it either way. I have my personal view. But finding that impersonality of the ongoingness of awareness and the ongoingness of a fundamental kind of sweetness in the heart toward that which arises in awareness, you know, you might locate that as something impersonal that you can feel increasingly is like a tide that's floating your boat higher and higher and higher.
Buddha, his path was not just straight from A to B, from A to enlightenment. He had to go through many lives, and in that some of those other lives he had to be purified of wicked things that he had done. I can't think, I was poking around in some book I have on Buddha, it goes into quite a discussion of that. He didn't just go from straight from this point to enlightenment.
Right.
A whole lot, he went through a whole lot of revision.
Mishigas, that's the word you're searching for there. A whole lot of mishigas, a whole lot of trouble. No, okay, let me speak to that on our way to end here. So one way to think about the Buddha, and it's a traditional way, is that the historical Buddha had many previous lives. And there were many times of purification in those previous lives. I think that's what Nancy's talking about here. That may well be true, and a lot of people think that's true. Another way of looking at it is that the Buddha had one lifetime, and we can stay inside that frame as well. And it's also really true that in that lifetime, he had lots of zigs and zags. And so we get to have our own zigs and zags too. The question is, what do we take refuge in along the way? Life is difficult, right? That's the opening line to The Road Less Traveled, Scott Peck's great book. Life is difficult. There is dukkha. There is suffering and difficulty, the First Noble Truth. What are the things that we draw upon, that we, find as our safety, like kids playing hide-and-seek, you know, that we use as our home base, right? What do we use for that along the way? And so that, this week, I really encourage you, if you want, to join me in a practice I do routinely, which is on first waking, I take refuge. You know, I think of the things that are real for me. I get a felt sense of them. I let them be my condition, as if they are already true. And then I kind of get a feeling of it, good, ready to meet the day. So you might want to think about that. Okay, let's sit for a minute and let this sink in. May you find refuge. See you next week.